I'm extremely excited to announce a brand new sponsor for the Behind the Shield podcast, that is Transcend. Now, for many of you listening, you are probably working the same brutal shifts that I did for 14 years, suffering from sleep deprivation, body composition challenges, mental health challenges, libido, hair loss, etc. Now, when it comes to the world of hormone replacement and peptide therapy, what I have seen is a shift from doctors telling us that we were within normal limits, which was definitely incorrect, all the way to the other way now, where men's clinics are popping up left, right, and center. So I myself wanted to find a reputable company that would do an analysis of my physiology and then offer supplementations without ramming, for example, hormone replacement therapy down my throat. Now, I came across Transcend because they have an altruistic arm, and they were a big reason why the 7X project I was a part of was able to proceed because of their generous donations. They also have the Transcend Foundations, where they're actually putting military and first responders through some of their therapies at no cost to the individual. So my own personal journey so far, filled in the online form, went to Quest, got blood drawn, and a few days later, I'm talking to one of their wellness professionals as they guide me through my results and the supplementation that they suggest. In my case specifically, because I transitioned out the fire service 5 years ago and been very diligent with my health, my testosterone was actually in a good place. So I went down the peptide route and some other supplements to try and maximize my physiology, knowing full well the damage that 14 years of shift work has done. Now, I also want to underline, because I think this is very important, that each of the therapies they offer, they will talk about the pros and cons. So for example, a lot of first responders in shift work, our testosterone will be low, but sometimes nutrition, exercise, and sleep can offset that on its own. So this company is not going to try and push you down a path, especially if it's one that you can't come back from. So whether it's libido, brain fog, inflammation, gut health, performance, sleep, this is definitely one of the most powerful tools in the toolbox. So to learn more, go to transcendcompany.com or listen to episode 808 of the Behind the Shield podcast with founder Ernie Colling. Welcome to the Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name is James Gearing, and this week it is my absolute honor to welcome on the show first responder therapist Phyllis Rogers. Now, Phyllis has been working with our professions for almost 2 decades now. So we discuss a host of topics, from her journey into the psychology space, working with first responders, the chaplaincy program, peer support, the 2020 riots, and so much more. Now, before we get to this incredible conversation, as I say every week, please just take a moment. Go to whichever app you listen to this on, subscribe to the show, leave feedback, and leave a rating. Every single 5-star rating truly does elevate this podcast, therefore making it easier for others to find. And this is a free library of well over 1,000 episodes now. So all I ask in return is that you help share these incredible men and women's stories so I can get them to every single person on planet Earth who needs to hear them. So with that being said, I introduce to you Phyllis Rogers. Enjoy. Well, Phyllis, I want to start by saying thank you so much for taking the time and coming on the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Oh, well, you're welcome. It's really an honor and a privilege, and it's been a joy to get to know you.
So where on planet Earth are we finding you, your morning, my afternoon?
I am in Carnation, which is a little town outside of the Seattle area, about 30 minutes outside of Seattle. And it's, I live on 12 and a half acres. It's lovely.
How was the pandemic for you having that kind of space? And I don't know if you have kind of, you grow your own food or anything as well, but it seems like it was just, you know, so challenging for people that were in the city that maybe lived in, you know, like a one bedroom apartment. But a lot of people I know that already had some space that were in the country seemed to have a better experience overall.
Well, it really was wonderful, you know, to be at home. And it was the transition of seeing clients in my office to seeing clients via video on telehealth. And I hadn't done much of that before. It was just kind of emerging. And so it was kind of fun to do it from home, but I was only home for about a month. And then the police departments and fire departments that I work with had me go home, you know, said, you need to not be here. And then after a month, they go, well, we need you back. And so I was really only home a month, and my clients wanted to see me in person. A few of them would do video after, you know, I was going back to the office. They wanted to see me in person, which I thought was interesting. So I am out there in the middle of the first responders who are also out there in the middle of the pandemic. So I didn't get to stay home as much as everybody else.
It was interesting. But it was fun. I was already out the fire service by then. And I remember hearing the guys saying, yeah, well, if, you know, if one of us is exposed, then the whole crew is out. And I'm like, I'm no mathematician, but that's not going to last very long. And sure enough, you know, after a couple of weeks, people were like, oh, we're losing everyone. Yeah, we're going to change those rules now. And it was funny watching these kind of, you know, elastic rules that were so hard and fast at the beginning. And then all of a sudden people realize, all right, maybe this isn't the best way of doing it. And, you know, it expanded and contracted constantly.
It certainly did. I felt sorry for the firefighters who had to put all this stuff on, you know, when they went. I mean, it took them twice as long to get to a call because they had to suit up, basically, and before they could go into a house.
What impact did you see that particular portion of our modern history have on the first responders that you work with? The reason I ask, obviously, I mean, you know, I think a lot of people were affected, but some of the coping mechanisms, certainly on the fire side, I know that we've used are, for example, the table, you know, the dining room table in the fire station. And I'm hearing that everyone's got to, you know, have some corner of the station to eat on their own. So the very nature of some of these, you know, arguably ridiculous distancing rules that were imposed seemed to take away a lot of the healing elements for our first responder community, and I'm sure amplified struggles they were already having.
I agree, but I don't know how long those guidelines really stayed in place, to be honest. You know, I think that they did at first, but when I, you know, would go to the fire station, they're sitting next to each other.
Good.
So, and you're right. That's how they process everything, you know, is around the kitchen table. And so I think in the beginning for a short time, they did follow that. But I think it fell away. They wouldn't say that out loud, I don't think. But it did fall away because they needed that. And, you know, the pandemic started here in Seattle. It was the first one. So we kind of, it spread out from here.
So what did you see? I mean, we'll get obviously into the whole first responder journey, but while we're on the topic, that phase specifically on the first responders that you actually, you know, take care of, what impact did, you know, all those factors have on the men and women in uniform?
Well, what I remember, it's been a while, what I remember is just feeling like no one was telling them really what was going on. I mean, they had people who were in charge of getting all the information, you know, daily, but the frustration of not getting what they needed, everything was in short supply, you know, not being able to work on the citizens like they normally did, and really restricting their calls. And, you know, it just was a very frustrating time for them.
I didn't, you know, really. No, please, yeah. Please.
Oh, well, they were the ones who were giving the vaccines. You know, that's where I went to get my vaccine shots, you know, was at the fire station because everybody who worked with them had to get them. And the medics were the ones giving them in the bay.
Yeah. Well, I think this was what was so unfair is the only word I think I can think of that matches this. That whole thing was so politicized, and you and I spoke yesterday on the phone. And, you know, we're talking about the word politics put on things sometimes that just need to be talked about. It's not politics, it's health. But you had the same first responders that were out there with you know, sometimes almost no PPE because of the shortage. They weren't vaccinated. There was no protection whatsoever. And then there was this mandate put on. And again, I think it's this organizational betrayal. Now they were being called murderers if they didn't take the vaccine. Now, I took the vaccine to go travel because I wanted to see my grandmother, who was 104 at the time. So I, you know, was like, okay, I will take one for the team because I want to lessen, you know, minimize the chance of me taking anything. But I also didn't think that the vaccine was going to stop the spread because that didn't match with the science that I've been taught since I was a little boy. But to see that, you know, complete 180 of these people that no one had an issue with at all being out there unprotected, and now they're being called murderers. And if they don't take the vaccines, they should be fired. Again, mentally, I felt that must have been extremely damaging to a lot of them.
It really was. And one of the most painful things for me is watching a group of firefighters taking a stance, and they banded together. There was a group of about 10, you know, and they met regularly. They all decided they weren't taking the vaccine, and they, even though they, you know, said that they were going to fire them if they didn't. And these were really good firefighters. They were some of the favorite people I enjoyed going to visit. And it went all the way up to one of the BCs, and they left. And it was so sad to see that happen. And it was so short-sighted by the cities who thought they were doing the right thing, but they lost really good people.
Yeah. And we're in a crisis now. And it's funny, LA is still terminating people. I had a guy that was terminated, I think it was the very beginning of 2024. And then I've been told that even now by a lawyer who's still defending, you know, LA first responders, he's like, no, they're still chasing people. And we know the efficacy was no more than the flip of a coin. And I'm not anti-vax. I've got a friend who was a doctor, and he was like, the vaccinated people seem to survive. You know, if you were already sick and you were vaccinated, it seemed to give you a better. So it's a, you know, maybe a symptom reducer, but as far as, you know, this is, if you don't take this, you should be terminated. There wasn't the efficacy to be behind that. If it absolutely stopped the virus in the tracks in your body, that's a whole different conversation, but that wasn't what was happening. And that even by the time they were terminating people, we knew that it wasn't 100% effective. So it was just such a spit in the face for all these veteran first responders who had done nothing but serve for so many years. And then they get either pushed out or terminated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. The other interesting thing I observed was the firefighters and the police officers were by the citizens heralded as the heroes, because they're out there doing their job in the midst of this horrible pandemic when everybody else was stuck in the house. And then all of a sudden George Floyd happened. And it was like this whole flip, not so much for the firefighters, but for the police officers. And it was, you know, almost shocking. It happened so fast.
Well, let's jump ahead. We haven't even got to your journey yet, but let's open that up. Because again, we were talking about this the other day. You know, I've had numerous people on, and obviously this topic has come up. You know, as a paramedic looking at that video, you know, knowing 14 years of calls that I've been on, you know, clearly there were some things that led to that death, and that's unacceptable. But even if you listen to the law enforcement, you know, the subject matter experts when it comes to these cases, those officers were prosecuted the way they should have been prosecuted. So it wasn't like it was swept under the rug. They had the book thrown at them, and each one of them had the charge that they deserved. So this is what was so sad. So while we're on this topic, we mentioned earlier when we spoke about riots. So, you know, paint the picture. What was the impact on the first responders that you were taking care of, as far as, you know, like you said, one minute they're heroes in the NHS in the UK, and at 5 o'clock, everyone was coming out and clapping, which I don't think creates more beds, nurses, or PPE, but regardless, at least you had support. And then, like you said, all of a sudden now law enforcement is demonized and defunded.
It was fascinating in many regards to watch, and heartbreaking for me at the same time. I was not working with Seattle PD at that time. I was contracted with him about a year later. But I was with King County Sheriff, Redmond PD, and a couple of other agencies in the surrounding area that were going in to help them. And, you know, I had someone who the National Guard who was deployed there. And so I, you know, I'm there as they're getting to go into the riots and experiencing the riots as they did. So in the beginning, I'm watching it on TV. I'm hearing these stories from those who've just gone in for a few days at a time. And I kept thinking, by the intensity of what was happening, that one of our officers or more were going to be killed. We were going to have some line of duty deaths. I'm still shocked to this day when I think about it that it didn't happen, because they were so intense. And as Seattle officers began to come see me at my office as clients, then I began to hear their stories, and their horrific stories. They were put on what's called a blue and gold schedule, which is 12 on and 12 off, and with no days off. And then occasionally they go, okay, your turn, you can have a day off. These guys and gals were exhausted. You know, by the time they often worked more than 12. And so by the time they got off and drove home, which none of them live in Seattle. They usually live about 45 minutes to an hour away. They get home, they hug their wife and their kids, they collapse in bed. Maybe they got a shower and something to eat, and they get up and grab something to eat and say goodbye. And families were abandoned by the officers during that time because the demand was so great. But I have been doing some groups for Seattle officers. We call it riot restoration, because I heard so much about the trauma that they had been through, and they had not dealt with it. And it had been last year, it had been 4 years, and I've been hearing this for 3-4 years now, and they're still angry. They're still hurt. They had let go of their anger at the citizens, who they would say in the beginning, they betrayed us. We would lay down our life for you, but you betrayed us. Because citizens would scream in their face horrible, horrible things. The things that they've told me, you know, I'm gonna murder your wife. I'm gonna rape your daughter. I'm going to just horrible things in their face. And they get right in their face, and the officers could do nothing. They were told they couldn't do anything. The city took away all of their tools. Now, the officers in Seattle are trained to handle riots. They train all the time for riots. So they know what to do. They knew how to handle it. And they took away all their tools to do it. And then on top of that, from what officers have told me, is that then a lot of the command staff didn't show up. No one would give them directions. Sometimes a sergeant wouldn't show up, or a lieutenant, and they had no direction. So they would self-appoint who was going to be in charge and then go out. And I work once a week at East Precinct, which is the center of the riots. And you know, the stories of when they sealed the main door and then they started a fire trying to burn them out. And it was just, the stories go on and on. And officers were getting injured. They were lighting fireworks. They were throwing frozen water bottles. They were throwing rocks at them. And they're standing trying to hold a line. And then one of their buddies next to them would go down, but they wouldn't know why or what happened. And the National Guard, who's standing behind him, would pull them out and take them to the hospital or whatever they needed. And then they'd have to close the line, but they wouldn't know for sometimes 8-12 hours if their friend was okay. And it was just so difficult on so many levels, and the trauma. They tell the stories and they laugh and they joke, but they haven't gotten down to really the emotional impact and the trauma that they went through. So I started this group. It took me 2 years to get the okay, but I finally started it. And it's been amazing, because this is the first time they've unpacked it. And I remember one of the first sessions that we had, one officer was over on my right telling his story, because I asked them to tell the story not the story they've told over and over again to their friends and their fellow officers, but the story of what they experienced. And so this officer is telling that story of what he went through, what he experienced. And to my left, all of a sudden I hear something, I look over and there's a sergeant just sobbing. And I realized immediately that he had never unpacked anything and that lid was starting to come off. And so it's been really wonderful to work with this. We only do 10 at a time. So it's a small group and it's a slow process for the size of agency it is, but it's a voluntary thing that they can come. They get to do it on duty. And those that have come have said that it has really made a difference. It's only 6 weeks. It's not that long for 2 hours. And I tell them, this is just the start point. This isn't the magic wand that'll heal it all. All of you will have to do more work, but at least it starts them on that journey. And one really cool thing just happened last week is one of the wives, who's also an officer, came to me and I'd never met her before. And she said, I just had to find you to tell you what a difference your group has made in my husband. He said, he's not as angry and it has just changed him and healed. You know, he's had a lot of healing and I just had to find you to say thank you, which was amazing.
One of the elephants that I see in the first responder mental health room is organizational betrayal or organizational mm-hmm. stress. Mm-hmm. Talk to me about the impact. And obviously that's one example. We were talking the other day, Capitol police officers after the insurrection. I think they were completely, turned that the nation turned their back on them. And I think it's disgusting. I mean, my personal opinion is we shouldn't be forgiving anyone that goes into a federal building. I mean, if you run through the TSA, you're going to get taken down or shot. That's how it works. You know, you can't just run into a building, but you dress yourself as a buffalo and now all of a sudden you're forgiven. I don't understand that at all. There's a lot of frustration with a lot of governments means that we have to do it a certain way. But, again, I don't think the Capitol Police had the support, not from their department, but from their nation, from the law enforcement community, from the people that should have stood up and said, what about them? They're, not that they're playing a victim, but they're the victims. They're the ones that thought they were going to die. They're the ones scrambling to protect all these people within this building. You know, no one knew what was actually going to happen when these people went in. And so I see a huge organizational betrayal there. What is the impact of organizational betrayal through your eyes on these first responders?
It's huge. It's been 4.5 years since the riots and the organizer, I call it admin betrayal, the admin or it's, the organizational betrayal they experienced during the riots of people. Command staff being afraid to make decisions, it was so tenuous and they feel so betrayed that they're still angry. And, I've asked them, what do you need to heal that anger and that resentfulness towards command staff? And one thing they've said is just to own what you did. And they go, but that'll never happen. They'll never own it. And there's a lot of truth there. One of the amazing things is we have a temporary chief at Seattle. She's they've hired the permanent chief. So she's leaving at the end of the month. But we sat down together and I told her about the group, which she didn't even know about, which was interesting. And she was the first person that actually said, I've been trying to figure out how to heal this department. And this is the missing link. You are bringing me the missing link of how to help them heal what they really are experiencing. Because if you talk to command, they don't get it. And I think that part of the betrayal, I told her that every reaction to anything command does goes through that filter from the riots. It's still there. And unless you heal that, it's going to continue to be that way until all of these officers are gone. And she was the first person who said, I want to sit down with some of those people and hear what they have to say. And I asked, I had two groups at that time, and I sent a text to them all and said, who would like to sit down, you know, with Chief Rohr? And everybody said, absolutely, I'm in. And because they want to be heard. And so many decisions come down that do not recognize the impact it will have on the line. And if they just cared about the impact, not just how it makes them look, or, you know, it might make the agency look better, but thinking about the officers, how is this going to impact the officers? How will they feel? I mean, it'd be novel for them to actually go and talk to the officers and say, I'm thinking about doing this. What's your thought? How do you think that'll impact you? That would be a novel idea. But I think that they often don't ask. They don't consider the feelings. And I think that, you know, anybody who feels, I always tell, anytime I have command staff's ear, I say, it's not that hard. Just if you help people feel valued and appreciated and that you have their back, they'll be loyal to the Corps. You won't have to pay them as much. You know, they'll work for less because they know you have their back and that you care about them and you appreciate them.
This is what I'm seeing is rampant in the fire side as well. And I've talked about this all the time, but most of the fire service, the firefighters work 56 hours a week, the career firefighters. Mm-hmm. And, you know, by that devolving working environment, and then the recruitment crisis creating more and more overtime, and now these people are working 80 hours a week. The solution is to obviously address that, make a healthy work week. And if you compare police and fire, police work about 40 hours. So it's insanity. But there's such a pushback, especially from the, and I'm using air quotes, top, because I think that's being generous. And we've got to take a step back and go, so let me get this straight. The men and women who work 40 hours a week, who go home at five every night and sleep in their own bed, are telling the firefighters on the line that they can't work less than 56 and they can't go back to their family. See, this is exactly it. I mean, we have to take a, you know, really kind of reframe what our position is. And we are supposed to be servants, public servants. Well, if you're at a higher rank, the people you're serving is your men and women in uniform. The men in uniform are actually serving the public, but you're serving your people. And yeah. I'm seeing such a disconnect. And we've got to refine that community, that tribal element of police, fire, EMS, dispatch, corrections, all the uniform professions.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, if I ever get a chance to talk to a new sergeant, or in fire it'd be a lieutenant, that I say, you are the most important person in the entire agency. And I said, because you have the ear of the line. And you are the one who will know what's going on at home, how they're doing at work, what they're struggling with, you know, are they doing well, are they not? And you're going to know everything about them. And you are the one who can make them feel valued and cared for and come alongside when they, you know, mess up, which everybody does from time to time, instead of, you know, just criticizes and disciplining them, which some sergeants and lieutenants, you know, come down really hard. But if you come alongside and say, hey, we need to work on this, let me help you, or this other, you know, officer or firefighter can work with you, and you really have their back in that way, I try to encourage them to see that, because there are really good sergeants and lieutenants in both areas, and there's some who just don't get it, and they make their squads or, you know, teams feel disconnected.
I was listening to Joe Rogan a while ago, and he had a man on, Sadhguru, who's this kind of, you know, Indian guru gentleman. But he made a comment, because Joe was talking about, you know, the kind of evil pharmaceutical companies and all that. And he was talking about struggling. And the guy said, yeah, they're struggling too. And I'd never thought about that. If you are the head of, you know, William Morris and you make cigarettes, or you're a head of, Purdue Pharma and you create OxyContin, and you can sleep in your bed soundly at night knowing that hundreds of thousands of Americans are dying from your product, I would argue there's a mental health issue. You're borderline sociopath. When I look at the first responder professions, like locally, the county that protects me, who've had 4 suicides in 4 years and still refuse to do anything to change the work week and some other areas, I would argue that one of the issues is we're not considering that maybe even the people or the bugles have to go and do the work, and they don't have the mental capacity to have that empathy because they've got their own challenges in their head as well. That's my opinion. What is your perception of that?
Well, I'm sorry, I asked the question again. All of a sudden, my mind was going a different direction.
No problem. So my thing is, you know, rather than, you know, they're the bad guys, because they are, their actions are absolutely the bad guys. If you, again, like, look at the Sackler family and what happened with OxyContin, it was disgusting. But when you frame it as those people have mental health challenges, it then to me, it's like, all right, well, this chief that doesn't seem to care about all their people dying, if they got some help, would they refine their empathy and start fighting for their people? So it's not a judgmental issue, but, you know, I think that some of these people are in these positions that have been carrying their own baggage. And if left unaddressed, they can bury it down, go home at 5 and not think about anyone else.
And that's how the line often feels, that whether or not that's true, that's how they feel about them. You know, I know that command staff, or, you know, those who are leading organizations, I know it's not easy, but sometimes my perception and observation is they care more about their image and the money they make and the politics than they do about people. And that's where I would love to see, as they promote people, not, you know, I don't know how, you know, people listening to the broadcast probably know, but there's a lot, it's a long journey to test to go up. You know, you jump through a lot of hoops and you have to study and, you know, books and tests and all that. But so it's the people who take tests well and study well and are smart that often get promoted, but they don't always have emotional intelligence. And that's what bothers me. I would like to see them promote people and have some type of evaluation of what is their emotional intelligence. How do they connect with people? Do they understand, you know, what people are going through? Do they think of the others below them? That's what I would like to see happen. And the other thing that you mentioned is about the hours. You know, sleep is... I had somebody come in my office. I've been doing this for 18 years, working with first responders as an MHP. And someone came into my office a couple of weeks ago, and I always ask about sleep, and they go, "Oh, you know, I sleep really well." And I go, "Are you lying to me?" Because I never have anyone say that, because they just don't sleep. Firefighters and police officers, the same. And sleep is the foundation of good mental health, emotional health, physical health. It's the foundation of everything. And it you know, we should pay more attention. I've never understood the fire schedule. I think it's crazy. I always have. We have one agency in our area. I see someone from there, and he was explaining that they're going to 24 hours on and 3 days off, which is a definite improvement because they do all 48s up here. And I was happy to hear that they're actually paying attention to sleep. But it's costing them money and they're paying it. They have to hire more people because they're going to more crews. I love it. I think that they're putting value on people over, you know, the money, the politics, or whatever causes them to not want to spend the money to do a different schedule.
I wonder if it's the department. I was just talking to someone and we chatted a while ago, and he actually reached out to me a couple of days ago and said, "Hey, James, just want to let you know I'm 5 shifts into the 24/72. And so we talked about this because I've been championing this for 8 years now, and it's not my idea. There's departments that have already done it. It's just, to me, when, you know, you start listening to all these experts, you're like, well, sleep is important. What's the answer? Well, more rest between shifts. Okay. 42-hour work week. Well, that's what everyone else works. It's not, you know, some crazy, hey, we just want to work 5 hours a week. You know, it just, can we work the same as everyone else? Is that okay? We are saving lives and getting up in the middle of the night. But that's what's, you know, so interesting is this is the solution. And the money, ironically, if you look at Seattle, for example, if you just ask them, how much do you spend on overtime? It will be millions and millions and millions of dollars. And that's because they're filling these holes in this recruitment crisis. What departments here, because we had a beautiful year last year where 7 fire departments made the move, including Palm Beach County, which is a huge one. When that happens, they're getting people lining up around the building again to become a firefighter for them. Because you, just like you touched on earlier, we're showing you that we care about you. We're investing in you. We want to give you an environment and sets you up for success, gets you home with your family so you can be at those games and recitals with your children, the rest and recovery. And even, I think this is a really important thing too, now you have the kind of latitude to forge, you know, a second career, not like work, you know, all hours God sent. But if you're a personal trainer or, you know, you're a painter or a cabinet fitter or whatever it is, now you can go work 8 hours on some of these days, and God forbid you get laid off, you get hurt, you get fired. You have this other tribe and this other career as well. But the money that's saved once they fill all the vacancies, because people want to work for you, now these cities and counties are going to save millions and millions every single year, which now could go into hiring mental health counselors, putting gyms in stations, all the things that will only continue to improve. So this is what I love. And in the Northwest, some of them have the 4-platoon system, but they work debit days, which is crazy to me. Yeah. Like, here's a 42-hour work week, but it's only 42 hours. So we need you to work more. And again, coming from someone that works 40. But I think they're closer. So I think the Northwest might be another Florida as this kind of gets some legs. Hopefully other departments will get away, because the push was to go to a 48-96, which is insane. 48 hours in a busy department. But it's what they say, a little knowledge is a dangerous thing. People found a study, which was a study on a department that ran about 1 call a shift, almost no calls at night. And then Seattle or whoever the large department ran with it, like, oh, this is a better shift. And it's like, no. That's like saying, you know, my doctor told me cigarettes are good for me, so I'm going to start smoking.
Exactly. Well, I always think, you're at your 48s, and I have the firefighters who come see me. They, you know, they've worked 48 and then they're going out on calls. You know, sometimes at the end of the shift, a call comes in, they got to go. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, sleep deprivation is like being at, you know, alcohol level, and the brain is not functioning. And what are they thinking? I just worry about them. And then they're driving these $1 million rigs around. So I just think, I'm surprised we haven't had more disasters, but I hope that it changed. I'm glad that you're advocating. It's never made sense to me. So I'm so glad to hear that you're advocating that schedule.
Yeah. I mean, I think for performance, for mental health, for all the things, it's a no-brainer, but it's just, I'll be completely honest. You know, we are completely brainwashed in the fire service because we are a selfless group. There are people all over the country that do it for no money whatsoever. And so that is still kind of hanging on. But where other companies have evolved as things have got bigger and bigger, stores or, you know, train lines or whatever that industry is, they hire more people, they expand. And the fire service, I think, sadly, because they know that we're going to go regardless because we want to serve people, that's been taken advantage of, and which is why we're so far from where we need to be. So the future of the fire service, I hope, is longevity, is a higher level of fitness and performance. And hopefully 10 years from now, young recruits will walk through a door and they won't be greeted with, oh, you wait, 10 years from now, you'll be on your third divorce and an alcoholic. You know, that's just, I mean, if that's not a red flag, I don't know what is.
Yeah. Well, sometimes when I've asked firefighters about it, they actually really have said to me, I like the schedule because I have all these days off and I could trade out, you know, and take a vacation without taking vacation time. And You know, so I've gotten a little pushback from the firefighters as well.
Yeah, I have too. And I'm in the process of writing a piece on cowardice in the fire service. And it's exactly that. If you're pushing back against more time at home, then you've completely lost your way. You know, if you just think this identity of being at work is more important than being present with your children, especially if we're talking about multi-generational trauma, if you were never there, you are destroying your kids' mental health. So it's really reframing it and getting away from this kind of, you know, chest beating face, fake machismo that seems to be, you know, around at the moment, and refind what is most important. To me, my family was even before the fire service, which is why I traveled all the way to the West Coast and all the way back to the East, because I put my family first. So if you put that back front and center, and then you learn the impact of sleep deprivation on the chances of our children having pediatric diseases goes up immensely, then it's for them. You know, it's not about you and your mustache and your selfies. It's about your family, your relationship, your children's health, and your ability to be present. But like you said, that's a hard sell, especially, you know, when you do have an overworked, stressed, you know, men and women in uniform, the ability to critically think goes down and you do become a zombie and you just keep doing what you've always been doing.
Yes, I agree.
All right. Well, you mentioned about 18 years in mental health and first responder profession. Let's kind of finally go back to your early life. So tell me where you were born and tell me a little bit about family dynamic, what your parents did, how many siblings.
Wow, you're really going back. I grew up in a small farming town in Central California. It was Ripon. It was a Dutch farming community, and it was a great place to grow up. You know, it was when you roamed the streets at a young age without parents, and I had three other siblings, but they were much older than I was. I have a sister who's 13 years older, a brother 11 years older, and a brother 4 years older. So I have some only child characteristics and youngest child characteristics, which is an interesting combination.
So what did your parents do as occupation?
Oh, well, my dad was in the propane business. So he provided the propane to the farmers. And then my mom was his bookkeeper. So I grew up in a home where mom worked, which was very rare in those days. Yeah.
Absolutely.
So I often came home as a young kid. I even remember first and second grade and no one was home. Yeah. My dad would say, oh, well, she can come down to the store because I could walk there, but it was so boring.
I was lucky. My dad was a veterinary surgeon, so it wasn't boring going to work with him, you know, fixing animals.
Nice.
When you reflect,
we did have horses and, you know, we had every animal known to man at some point.
Well, speaking of that, so when you reflect back now, and we talked before about where you're living now and having this kind of, you know, nature all around you and the healing elements there, what were the, whether it's the way you ate, the way you moved, you know, mental health tools that were kind of woven in, what were the good things about that upbringing? And were there any things that were actually detrimental as you unpacked it later in life?
Well, the good things were I was surrounded by a community that knew me and loved me, which is good and bad. Sometimes, you know, as I got older, they knew everything before, you know, my parents did sometimes, but it was really a wonderful community. You know, I could hop on my bike and ride anywhere, and wherever you were, the mom at lunchtime, the mom just fed you, you know, and at five, she shooed everybody home. I mean, it was just a really wonderful, you know, way to grow up, learning at a young age how to work. You know, I started working as soon as you could get your permit to work, which was, I think, 12. No, I think it was younger than that, because I was like between fifth and sixth grade. I would get up at 5 a.m. and go pick berries, you know, so learned work ethic at a young age. We had walnuts and almonds, or almonds, as you East Coasters call them, and grapes. Yeah, I mean, we had all that we farmed ourselves on our own property, as well as helping others. And so, you know, it was a great way to grow up. The downside, you know, as I grew up, I did have to deal with some sexual abuse by a brother when I was in junior high. and, you know, was raped when I was 16 on a date. So, you know, there was some tough stuff that happened there too. And, you know, as I've gotten older and talked to others, you know, there were others in our community who suffered those kind of things as well. And it was all a big secret. No one ever talked about it. You know, if someone got pregnant, they were sent away and they'd come home after the baby was born. So it was that kind of community as well. So that would be the downside.
Yeah, that's a absolutely awful downside. I'm so sorry that happened to you. I've heard it so much, though. I mean, people come on here, obviously a lot of them are military and first responders, but a lot of them from other areas too. And you know, the prevalence of sexual abuse in our uniform professions, for example, is, you know, a lot of them who are men, you know, is far greater than I ever thought. When you reflect back now generationally, what were some of the kind of contributing factors that added to the prevalence of this in your community?
That's a really good question. If we're talking multi-generationally, and as my, you know, with my therapist hat on, I think these patterns were passed down for generations. I'm curious where it started. My grandparents came from Holland when they were in their 20s. They didn't know each other until they came to the United States. You know, today I would call my grandfather a pedophile. I didn't mention my grandfather, but he, you know, since early age, three, you know, he would do things and, you know, it just made me uncomfortable. And it was as an adult talking to my cousin, you know, I think that she, you know, described some things too. So I'm wondering how many grandchildren, because there's 12 kids in my dad's family. You know, one died in World War II as a pilot. So there, we had lots of grandkids. You know, he had lots of grandkids. I wondered how the sisters, my aunts, you know, I wondered what they experienced growing up. And where did this start? Because it doesn't come out of nowhere. Usually something's happened to them that creates this behavior. So generationally, you know, I'd be curious to go back to find out where it started. But I think a closed community that aren't talking and that they keep secrets, you know, it's about image, and it can be very shame-based, is what perpetuates this under the waterline.
It's funny because you could be describing police or fire right now with that same description. So reflecting on the community, then, they say it takes a village, you know, to raise a child, and I agree completely. And I feel like this is one of the things we've got away that are contributing to some of the issues that we see in society. And you have, you know, let's say they're not even single parents, a couple, and they've got four children, and they're trying to balance daycare and the jobs, and you know, they're passing like ships in the night. And if you look at, you know, tribal humans, those children, as just like you were saying, would have been kind of raised collectively by everyone. So we talked about the dark side of what, you know, wasn't spoken about. What about that element of community? And you know, do we need to kind of refine that to raise these young people and maybe even stop this multi-generational trauma?
Well, I'm not sure I have the answer to how to stop it, but what I've heard so many stories of even, like you said, even guys, I probably have had equal on both sides, men and women, but it's often probably the most prevalent has been the babysitter. It was the neighbor who babysat because mom was working. You know, I went there every day after school, or it was the neighbor's dad, you know? So I think that we as parents need to be extremely careful who we leave our children with and make sure we know and trust them. Because that's where I hear of it again and again and again and again.
I just had, what was he a member of? I'm blanking which law enforcement task force he was a part of, but he was hunting pedophiles and then putting cases together against them. And he was saying exactly that, you know, the coach, the school teacher, the priest, you know. And I remember someone asked if my son wanted to join the Scouts, and I was like, no. And it wasn't that those individuals locally that I thought they were all pedos, but it's just, you know, once bitten, twice shy. When organizations have failed to actually address what's going on, then of course you're going to be cautious. And, you know, if I'm not be able to oversee that happening, and my son did like the JROTC program. So they did like a camp, a military camp for like 4 days. And so he got a taste of that kind of, you know, scout camping thing, but surrounded by lots and lots of children and teachers. So no one was kind of isolated. But yeah, I'll be completely honest, that terrified me. You know, it's a shame, because I got lots of friends that are, you know, Eagle Scouts, scout leaders that I know do amazing things, but there's certain things I just wasn't willing to risk. And even my son, you know, sleepovers and that kind of thing. He was extremely, it was old by the time he did his sleepovers, because, you know, I couldn't, how do you know, you know, oh, they're nice. Okay. Well, they're nice, but that's exactly the profile of a pedophile is they're nice. They're loved by everyone. And that's why they're trusted. So it really is, it is tough. But I think, again, that community, you know, that village, if lots of people are looking, then, you know, maybe we'll reduce the ability for a predator to actually prey on a child. But if they're trusted in some basketball program and now everyone else has gone home except your child and the coach, you know, these are some of the things that are terrifying to me.
Well, and the other thing, I remember telling my mom in fifth grade, you know, that grandpa made me uncomfortable and would touch me, you know, in places. And she told me, but you shouldn't say things like that about your grandfather. And you know, she didn't believe me. And I think that we really need to, one, pay attention. When our kids say something, we need to pay attention. And we need to ask questions. And you know, believe them when they say certain things. And the other thing is to trust your gut. Because if you have somebody with your child or around your child that your gut just, you can't put your finger on it, but it just doesn't feel right, pay attention to that, because it's telling you something.
Absolutely. Yeah, I saw the documentary on Jared, the Subway spokesperson. And, you know, everyone again was trusting him. And it was actually a woman that had befriended him that no one was believing. And so she ended up taping phone calls with him. And he was talking about, he likes him, you know, the younger, the better. And I mean, he was a full on, like, extreme end pedophile. And it was just nauseating listening to him. But again, he's this beloved celebrity that people are throwing kids at, just like Michael Jackson, which, again, I don't understand the resistance to having that conversation. Clearly, he was grooming, because he would send the parents away and have the kids in his bedroom. But yeah, I mean, even now, but yeah, but he wore a beautiful, shiny glove and he could dance. So we'll just not talk about that. You know, how about we do talk about it? You know, I think it's, you know, just because they're charming doesn't mean it discounts. So they have to look like some creepy old homeless guy to be a pedophile in your eyes. And I think that that's an important thing for us to acknowledge, is that, yeah, you might know someone incredibly charming that you really like. That doesn't mean that they're not a danger to your child.
Yes.
All right. Well, then going back to your kind of career path, as you were in those formative years, those high school years especially, were you already thinking about psychology, or was there some other career aspiration in mind?
Well, I didn't have that career aspiration, but I always loved it. My senior year, they offered a psychology class for the first time, and I took it, and I realized I was always fascinated by that, because I wanted to understand why I felt the way I did, what I experienced, trying to unpack that. And so I think that's where my curiosity came from. But, you know, I met an amazing, lovely guy, who had just finished, his college at Stanford and moved down to where I was and met, and we fell in love. He was from Seattle. So that's how I ended up in Seattle. And you know, we were married, 10 years when we had 3 children. They were 3, 6, and 8. And he was 35 when he was in a car accident. And he was in a vegetative, he was in a coma for a year. And then, I don't know if you probably understand that it's kind of you know, you could put your hands in front of their face and there's nothing there. That would be a coma. But when, you know, when they come out, it's like an infant. They can make connection, you know, with their eyes with you. So, you know, then after a year, he was in that state until he died. And so the first 5 years, I just believed if we found the right therapy, the right doctors, the right something, he would get better. And so I was, I took care of him for several years at home, raising the three kids by myself. But after 5 years, I realized he wasn't going to get better. And I suddenly had to figure out how to take care of my family. And so I finally went into therapy, which I should have been in long before, but we were living below the poverty line on Social Security and disability. And I mean, we could barely afford food half the time. And so, so I went into therapy, and through the conversations, he encouraged me to go back to school, which is what my late husband, Scott, had always encouraged me to do. And so I only had 2 years of college. So I ended up going through a BA completion program and taking some classes at the junior college at the same time and raising the kids. I don't know how I did it, but you know, we do amazing things when we have to. I was 40. And so I didn't even know how to use a computer yet. And a friend gave me a used one, and I learned how to use, I took a class called Computers for the Fearful, and then learned how to do my papers online and on my computer. And at graduation, I saw those other students getting their hoods, and I'm like, I think I can do this. Look what I accomplished already. And so that was the moment I decided to go on and got my master's in counseling. So I started out, you know, just seeing, you know, it felt people would send those grief and loss and some trauma because they knew that was kind of my foundation. And then a couple years, maybe 2 or 3 years in, I got a call from a chaplain, a police and fire chaplain. And he says, Phyllis, I've been praying. We need another chaplain. And every time I pray, yours is the only name I get. And I go, a what? I never heard of it. And I heard of a hospital chaplain, but I didn't know what a police and fire chaplain was. But I knew in that moment, that was what I was to do. And so, you know, he began to bring me along with him and tell me how to do this work. And so I would see my clients 2 days a week, and then I would take the pager and, you know, I get dispatched in the middle of the night, 3 in the morning, and go to a call. And I would sit with the citizen. Usually it was a death, or they projected it was going to be a death, and typically fire called, but sometimes it was police. And then I would sit with the families. My favorite part of being a chaplain was I would show up and the BC or the officer in charge would meet me and go, oh, I'm so glad you're here. And they would give me a short, and then they'd walk me and introduce me. But just being so welcomed and invited, you know, and appreciated, you know, I loved that part. And so then I would sit with the family, and I was the one person that was consistent with the family. And, you know, they don't know who's a firefighter, who's a medic, you know, who's the police officer, or who do I talk to or ask this question. And so that was what I would do. And I would explain, you know, who these people were and if they had a question, who to ask. And then I would help them figure out if their loved one died, help them whether, you know, I'd explain, you know, we need the medical examiner to come out. And so we have an NJA now, you know, I explained all that and would help them if they needed a funeral home, I'd help them find one. And if it was a particularly bad call, then I would go back and meet with the firefighters and the officers and check on them and see how they were doing. And so learned how to do critical incident briefings, CISDs, and then they started coming to see me in my office, as well as, you know, I was working, seeing them while I was going out on calls. So I did that. I was a volunteer, volunteered my time for 7 years doing that. And I loved it. You know, it was great. And then the police chief, who was there at the time, came to me and said, I want to hire you as an MHP, a mental health provider, to be on site so many hours a week and then be available for crisis when they happen. And so I signed a contract with them. And a month later, King County Sheriff called, said, will you work with us and our peer support team? And then another agency called. And, you know, it just started to unfold. I often say I have an accidental business. I never set out to have this business, but I, you know, it just kept growing and they wanted more and more MHPs on site. It was just at that edge where they're starting to do that. And so I had to hire some other therapists to work with me, and they all see clients as they all see clients, and then they also work on site at an agency. We have 10 contracts with different agencies in the area. And so 3 years ago, about a year after the riots, Seattle PD had a line of duty death. And one of the officers that I'd gotten to know called me, you know, at 7 o'clock in the morning, said, we need you, will you come? So I canceled my entire week and sat with them. And one of my King County sergeants, who was a friend, said, you know, they're going to go after you. And I said, no, they're not. I am just helping them out. And 6 weeks later, I got a call. Can we talk? We'd like to hire you to put MHPs at each precinct, which, you know, was an amazing thing for them to do. And so that's when I started to work with Seattle as well, which has been probably the biggest undertaking of all agencies I've worked with.
I can imagine. Going back to your husband for a moment, did you have to make the decision to terminate, or did he pass away on his own?
Well, I had some brave souls along the way ask me, you know, have you thought about, you know, removing life support? And I would say no. I would never even think of that. Because Scott was really a major part of my healing journey, you know, through all of that, with that abuse and all of that. And he was the one who believed in me. And, you know, in 10 years, my life changed so much from him and just his incredible love for me, that there was no way I was just gonna, you know, take his life support. And I wanted to take care of him. But after I got my master's degree and I was working, we had a disability attorney. So I went to him and he knew I'd been in school. And I said, what do I do now? I said, I can't work, because I couldn't go to work because he was on Medicaid. And if I went to work, I'd have to pay, he was now in a nursing home, I'd have to pay the $10,000 of his care and make enough money to take care of our family. And I just wasn't capable of that. And so he said, well, have you ever thought about removing life support? And later he called it a 2 Kleenex box meeting, because he gave me a box of Kleenex and I went through it and I had to go get another one, because I just sat there and cried. I just couldn't imagine. And it wasn't long, maybe 6 months earlier, there'd been a big case in the news where, you know, there was a battle between the mom and dad of this person and the wife. And I said, I do not want to go there. And I don't want, my kids have been through enough. I don't want them to go through that too. And so I remember going out to the parking lot and I couldn't even drive for almost an hour because I was just so upset. But I began to think about it. And one thing I'd learned through all of that experience is I didn't make a decision. If I waited for that gut level piece, it was always the right decision. But if I jumped out and made a decision before that, it was often the wrong decision. So I only told 2 people. One was a close friend who was a therapist, and one was Scott's mom. And she was very supportive. And she said, whatever you decide to do, Phyllis, it's up to you. And it took me 3 months to be able to come to that decision. And so I sat down with his parents and they were very, you know, supportive. And they said, you know, you've been amazing at how you've taken care of Scott. And we, you know, are there for whatever you need to do. It wasn't easy for them. It was hard too. And then I met with each of my kids one-on-one, and they cried and cried. And I said, well, what do you think your dad would want? Do you think he would want to stay in this state? Or be free and be able to walk again in heaven? And they go, oh, to, you know, be able to walk and run again. I said, okay. And then I met with each of his siblings. So, you know, my in-laws, I met with each one of his brother, his sister and two brothers, and talked to them. And then the requirement, the law, at least in Washington, I had to have two doctors verify that it was appropriate. And then the facility he was in had to agree. So there was a little bit of issue with the facility, and the attorney got involved, but we worked through all that. And so finally, I mean, it was like 5 months later, you know, we finally had all the approvals, and I sat there, you know, after all of that, it was a very simple thing. He was in hospice at that point. We had moved him to hospice, and the nurse said, are you ready? I mean, basically just took out the feeding tube. Mm-hmm. And it was such a quiet, simple process. And after such emotional agony, and, you know, the kids said, please let us know when it's done. So I just called the school and said, will you just give them a message? It's done. And so then we waited, and he lived for over a week. And the nurse came to me and said, you know, I know you wanted to take him home. That wasn't an option in the beginning. And she said, if you want to take him home, you need to take him home now. And so we arranged to take him home, and an ambulance, private ambulance came to get him. We loaded him, and I'm sitting in the back and with him. And I had the most amazing experience that's hard to really explain, but he stared at me the entire time, and just with so much love, and he wasn't cognitive, able to really process a lot, but he just stared at me, and I could hear in my spirit him thanking me and telling me how much he loved me. And we got in the house, and the hospice nurse was there. We got him set up. And within an hour, he went into respiratory arrest. And then, you know, it was just the morphine after that. And the next morning, we're all sitting around his bed. And I'm sure you know what it's like, that last breath. You know, you kind of think, oh, was that it? And then he breathes again. Oh, okay. And then you hold your breath. Okay, is that one it? And then finally, no more breaths came. And I just had this vision immediately of him jumping, yelling, and screaming when he arrived in heaven. And everybody's turning around and going, who was that just got here?
Yeah, well, I mean, thank you for sharing that. I think it's important, and there may be some people listening that are having to consider that decision. I actually, when I was in medic school, it was a bizarre shift at work on my fire department. I delivered a baby, and then I went and did a clinical literally that same day. I think it was that evening. I was in the ICU and extubated a terminally ill patient. So I kind of brought a life in and then, you know, helped someone leave. And it's such a difficult decision for these families to make. But when you think about the quality of life, and you gave it so much time, you know, because you do hear of these recovery stories, but you know, when is that line? When is enough enough? And, you know, now you were able to have closure with your children as well. So, I mean, I can't imagine how hard that must've been, but, on the same time, the upside of it as well.
Yeah. There were lots of tears.
I can imagine. Well, yeah. You talked about, you know, elements of abuse that you had early when you were a young woman. And then, you know, Scott helps you in this incredible healing journey. And then he has this catastrophic, you know, event in the car. And now you're having to remove the feeding tube and then watch him leave you again. What were the tools that you lent into for your own mental health? I mean, we've been talking about how you're helping other people. What was your toolbox that you accumulated after losing your soulmate?
Mm. You know, I found that the being in therapy was a big part of my journey. And I had an amazing psychologist that I met with and the one who encouraged me to go back to school. And you know, I'm still in contact with him. He was a big part, but also the support I had around me made a lot of difference. I read a lot during that time to help understand my own process. I think I get asked the question a lot of how I handle all the stories, you know, that I hear and from, you know, being on scene myself and how do I deal with that trauma? And we live in a place that, you know, is 12 and a half acres. I look at the mountains and the trees and I've really found that that is an important part for me. When I was having a really tough day when Scott was alive, I would grab my journal, my Bible and a blanket, and I would go find the water. And I would sit in a park, you know, and I would write and write and write and sit and stare at the water. And there's something that would, I call it nurture my soul. And often I'd sit there till I was shaking, I was so cold, and I'd have to go back in the car and drive home. But I've always found part of it is nature and just it calms my soul. And the other is friends, you know, who really are empathic and understanding and willing to support me and walk alongside me. I don't think I could have gotten through all of that healing journey and from Scott and the abuse, all of it, without having good people around me who love me dearly.
Well, it's interesting reflecting what people were told during the pandemic. The reason why I talk about the pandemic still is that there are things that we can take away. I feel that was an element of just sweeping it under the rug and we don't want to talk about it now. Well, when, you know, when are we going to learn what went well and what went, you know, terribly if we don't kind of pick it apart after the fact? But being told to stay in your house, being told not to be around your friends and family. I mean, you know, then the nutritional side, fast food, alcohol delivered to your house, binge watch Netflix. I mean, there are so many things that go against what actually forges good mental health. But when I hear and ask people that question, how do you decompress? Just the last guest before you yesterday, same thing. He's a surfer. He's a free diver. It's the water. I go to Crescent Beach. For me, it's the water. It's nature. It's all these things. So, you know, next time if there's a pandemic, I hope where people are like, no, go to the beach, go to the park. Don't lick each other's faces. Let's not go crazy now. But, you know, get in the daylight, get the sun on your skin and get dirt under your nails. And these are the things that kept a lot of people healthy for a long time. And even when I reflect on my early life, which had, you know, numerous traumas, why didn't I get as low as some of these, you know, men and women I had on the show? Mm-hmm. It's because that was woven into my childhood just by pure luck, just chance. I was on a farm, you know, my dad healed animals. So I had equine therapy. I had canine therapy. I had, you know, nature. I had a large dining room table that we all laughed and joked around, my family. So, you know, these simple human elements are so, so important. And you reflect on living in New York City, this concrete jungle, how many of those healing elements are just, they're just not available. So I think these are really important to reflect on, you know, what are the things that work and how can people kind of position themselves to be able to be outside more and do all these things that seem to naturally help the healing process.
I agree. But I think it's different for everybody. I probably hear as I asked that question to the first responders and hiking, being out on my dirt bike, those are the things that I hear most often from them. So I think that that's true for a lot of them, but for some it's different. For some it's staying quiet and reading a book in front of the fireplace, or, you know, it's about finding what works for you. What nurtures your soul, and then do that.
Absolutely. Well, you mentioned about going into our profession 18 years ago. Talk to me about the first impression, what was already good and what was absolutely terrible. And then what is the metamorphosis that you've seen over the last almost two decades as far as things that are hopefully moving in the right direction?
Well, that's a wide open question. one of the things that I remember early on thinking about is the connection I made with these first responders. Now, the chaplain, Pat, who was kind of mentoring me, he said, it'll take you probably 2 years. It's about building trust, and because they don't trust anyone. And so it takes time to build that trust. It'll take you about 2 years. And in 6 months, I was totally in for various reasons because of different crises that I showed up on and helped them with, some of them personal. And suddenly I was in. And I'm like, that they trusted me. And I had never talked to a police officer, other than when I got pulled over as a teen for speeding or rolling through a stop sign. But, they were such wonderful people and such quality people. That was my first impression as I got to know them and built relationships with them. And, but one of the hard part was seeing the impact of the career they had chosen on their families. And when, for example, when the Lakewood Four, do you remember that, when they were killed here in our area, there were four officers in a coffee shop in Lakewood
who were killed. Vaguely, what's so sad is there have been so many. I can think of the ones that were shot eating Chinese food. I mean, they all kind of blurs together now. So I'm sure I remember when it happened. But I mean, the execution of police officers is just horrendous these days.
It is. Well, we had about six, those two more, and then those four that were all kind of bang, bang, bang. So Seattle, anybody in this area will remember the Lakewood Four well. Anyway, they were in a coffee shop and someone came in and shot them all. And then there was a big manhunt. So everybody was involved. But after the Lakewood Shore, as soon as I heard it, I was at the police station asking the officers how they're doing, checking in with them. And it was interesting. They said to me, "I'm okay. It's my wife who's freaking out." And I'd never thought about them in that way until that moment. And I realized, because I asked some more questions, I said, "Well, what are they worried about? They're worried about me getting killed that way." And they kept saying to me, officer after officer, "They want me to quit my job." And so that's what I realized, is how much the spouses carry of concern and worry, and have talked a lot to them about that sense, what it's like to be married to a first responder. It's not easy. They're gone a lot. I had one officer's wife who, he was on SWAT, so he'd get paged out in the middle of the night, and then she'd be, wondering, is he going to be okay? Is he not going to be okay? And then one night she got the call that he'd been shot, he didn't die. He recovered. But, it took her years to recover from that phone call and that experience. So they suffer a great deal and no one notices. I think a lot of times even the agencies don't pay attention to the spouses and what they go through.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is, again, one of my main arguments here is I had a friend of mine who's a firefighter in this local department and his wife, who's a nurse practitioner, and they came on together. And, my friend is amazing, but he's indoctrinated into that culture. So hearing his wife's, perspective of what happens just even when it's the normal shift, but then that mandatory overtime. You're supposed to be coming home. She's a career woman as well. They've got two kids. The impact of that, because this is what is not being factored in. This is, you got to stay another shift. We're shorthanded. Well, there's a lot of other people that are affected by that decision. And again, it's the wildfires in LA. Okay, I get it. There's an absolute, disaster happening at the moment. But you're using this as a staffing model for a decade. That's so unfair on the families of these first responders.
Mm-hmm. It is. And they're exhausted. And I hear the story again and again of, he comes in the door, he's worked, a 48, or, been out on a call. Someone was murdered and had to do an investigation, worked way overtime. And then he walks in and the wife hands him the baby and says, here, I can't do it anymore. And he's exhausted, but she's exhausted too. So what do? You have a baby to take care of, you know? I have a lot of couples, first responder couples that come to see me. You know, I talked about you've got to talk through how you manage those moments. You know, what do you each need? Maybe he needs a few minutes to change his clothes, to take a shower, and then maybe he'll take the baby, you know, and you can have a break. But how to communicate what you both need is so important. And then we talk about how do you talk about what you experienced on the job, because that's a tough one too. Some don't tell their spouse anything, and some can tell them everything. Well, it depends if you're married to another first responder or an ICU nurse or the emergency room nurse, a lot of those. And they can take those stories because they have their own to tell. But there's others that can't take the story. And so how, you know, and they say, well, I don't want to traumatize them, so I don't tell them anything. Well, I get that and I appreciate that. But you need to say, I had a really rough call. It was a kid call. You know, or whatever, a little bit of information. Otherwise, they think you're mad at them. You know, they disappear, they isolate, and the spouse thinks, what did I do wrong? Did I say something? You know, they don't know. It's not them. And so communication is so important in the first responder couple.
Absolutely. What about the I almost don't like the word stigma anymore, because it seems like a lot of us have got stuck on that word rather than, you know, healing tools and post-traumatic growth and all the things that are over that fence that's called stigma. But in the law enforcement profession, you hear even more fear of talking because of having your badge and gun taken away, versus in the fire service, we don't have a gun. So it's not, you know, that particular element isn't as acute. What have you seen as far as that issue, that barrier to courageous vulnerability from when you first entered to where we are in 2025?
Well, I actually think a lot of first responders shut down more over time. You know, they stuff everything. They push it down and don't want to talk about it. And I advocate, when you have a critical incident, you need to deal with it then, because it accumulates. And the cumulative trauma is what can wipe out officers and firefighters. You know, I've had a medic just recently who's had some really rough calls over the years. And he said, I can hardly stay at work. It is so hard just to be there. And so it's so important to deal with each one as you go. And these older first responders didn't get that training when they first came in. This is new of really the last 10 or 15 years. You know, if you aren't a newer officer or firefighter, you didn't learn about mental health and why it's important. And it was kind of looked down upon. You know, that was the era of suck it up, buttercup. And I'm so, that you asked about change that I've seen, that is the one I'm so happy to see. I often think of it like a large cargo ship, container ship. They say it takes 10 miles for them to turn out in the ocean. And that's what I think it's like for mental health and first responders. You know, it's been a long 10 or plus years, you know, to make that turn. But I think we've made the turn and we're coming around, and mental health is valued and encouraged. And there's more mental health like me on site at agencies, and it's growing. So that's the one thing I am so grateful for to see happening.
What do you think is the gold standard model? And again, I get there's nuances in departments, but from the conversations that I've had, it seems like the on-site mental health counselor clinician is the best one, especially for me. If you make even the probationary, you know, the new recruits have X amount of sessions, I think that would be a beautiful way of addressing what we brought into the profession. So, and normalizing this conversation and having no barrier to entry because, oh, I already know Phyllis. I'm going to go talk to Phyllis about that kid call I just had. So if you, again, we talked about this the other day, queen for a day, what would be the gold standard model for mental health counselors or clinicians within a fire service or law enforcement, excuse me?
Well, what you said, I totally am on board with, and this is the piece that is just starting to happen, is that we catch them early on when they're at the academy, you know, that we start to talk about mental health and encourage good habits. Then we talk about sleep, how to talk to your spouse or your partner, how, you know, how to do all these things right from the beginning, lay a good foundation. And then as they come out of the academy and they're on probation, you know, that you're still checking in with them, seeing how they're doing on their mental health. I think having an MHP, people say, well, what do you do when you're on site? I said, well, I have the best job in the world. I get paid for just chatting with people. You know, I just walk around the stations and, you know, sit down and at the coffee table or lunch table and just chat and say, how you doing? And I build that relationship. I do ride-alongs and I'm just out there with them. It's amazing, the trust. I'd been gone for 4 weeks. And so last week when I was at one department, I had been there like 6 hours already and I was trying to get out the door. And every time I started, someone showed up and wanted to talk. And then I put, you know, going to get my jacket and someone else showed up. And then I finally went down to where everybody is just to tell, you know, the sergeants I was leaving. And then someone else caught me and somebody, it took me 2 hours to get out the door. And, you know, I think that is what's great, because once you build that trust, you know, and that you can encourage them to talk about things as they go, you know, they still has hesitations or they minimize something they've been through. But I think it's a good start, you know, to teach them how to have good health and to have somebody to talk to. There's always the holdouts and there always will be. There, you know, there's a couple of officers. I've been at East Precinct for Seattle PD for 3.5 years now, and there's still some holdouts. They'll probably, you know, never really come and share anything. But I try to engage with them. I kind of in my mind, I target them and go, okay, there's a challenge. I'm going to take that challenge on. And eventually, sometimes they'll open up, sometimes not. But at least I try. But that's what I would love to see everywhere. I did some classes with one agency, you know, doing that kind of program where we taught classes in their training, and then we had them see the MHP or a MHP and went over certain things like alcohol use and sleep and stress reduction and all of that, teaching them how to do all that. I thought it was a great program.
Yeah. Well, I think especially hearing how many of us have an ACE score of, you know, 6 and above in the first responder profession. I know that's not an absolute, but it seems like a lot of us do. That's a huge opportunity to start dealing with some of the stuff. I mean, if you become a police officer, you've already told us some of the things that you carried into the job. So turning those, you know, struggles into strengths, you know, allowing us to process them, because I truly believe, and I don't know if I'm just, you know, just all unicorns and rainbows, but I truly believe that if you have had some stuff happen and then you found your own toolbox to deal with it, I think that becomes a superpower in uniform. It really does. You're more empathetic and compassionate. You're more resilient. But if it's left unaddressed, that's a fractured foundation that can actually be detrimental as you progress through.
It can, because you'll be triggered on calls. And sometimes I call it the invisible string. It goes back to something else, but you don't know what it is. You don't know why you're reacting the way you are. But when you're doing your work, And that's the beauty of having an MHP on site, even if it's just once a week, which is what most of ours do, is I call it triage. We just triage. You know, if someone's struggling, you know, we'll sit and talk to them. But if we have to do therapy, then that's at the office.